Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Peter Shane. I direct the Center for Interdisciplinary Law and Policy Studies, and it's with great pleasure that we're kicking off our season of lectures, workshops, and seminars with the distinguished speaker who's addressing us today. If I may start a little personally, a little more than 25 years ago, I'd say a quarter century, but that sounds even longer, I had the good fortune to work for a small outfit in the U.S. Justice Department called the Office of Legal Counsel. And the job of that office is to advise the White House and other executive branch agencies on difficult questions of constitutional and statutory law. The head of the office at that time is a fellow named John Harmon, and he really believed that the office should be a kind of elite legal staff, and he tried to recruit people with that in mind. And over the years, it certainly has not been a surprise to me that those of my colleagues who left government have often turned out to be very successful, maybe always turned out to be very successful as law partners, law professors, even a few law deans. But of that entire group, I'm pretty sure that the person who actually has done the most good in the world is our speaker today. Catherine Fuller received her BA from Brown University. She did graduate studies in marine, estuarine, and environmental science at the University of Maryland and earned her JD from the University of Texas Law School. After working at the Office of Legal Counsel, Ms. Fuller took a position in what was then known as the Lands and Natural Resources Division of the Department of Justice, where she eventually became chief of the Wildlife and Marine Resources Section in 1981 and 1982. In 1982, she left Justice for the World Wildlife Federation, which, as you probably know, is one of the world's largest conservation organizations. And between 1982 and 1989, she held a variety of responsibilities within the World Wildlife Federation and the Conservation Foundation, including serving as the Executive Vice President and General Counsel, as well as the Director of the World Wildlife Federation's Public Policy and Wildlife Trade Monitoring Programs. In 1989, Catherine Fuller became president of the World Wildlife Federation, a position she held until 2005. She now chairs the board of the Ford Foundation, a philanthropic entity whose investment portfolio in the last fiscal year was worth $11.4 billion. Its grants and program-related investments support activities in the United States and approximately 50 other countries. With headquarters in New York City, it maintains offices throughout Asia, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, and Russia, all of which Catherine must now visit without carrying liquids. Catherine provides leadership across the full scope of Ford's mission to strengthen democratic values, reduce poverty and injustice, promote international cooperation, and advance human achievement both here and around the world. At the same time, Catherine found time in the last year to be a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and she is a recipient of the United Nations Environmental Program's Global 500 Award. It's with great pride and personal pleasure that I introduce Catherine Fuller.
Thank you, Peter. I assume that most people in the audience are lawyers, and I really feel as if those serious legal days are a long way behind me, but that time of the Office of Legal Counsel, we were just saying before we came in here, was extraordinarily special, a real opportunity to feel as if you were contributing as importantly as I feel that I ever have in my whole career. It was a wonderful opportunity and a wonderful group of people, and it is was great for me to get to know everybody there, including, of course, Peter, who's the reason that I am now here, having since we have kept up a little bit here and there over the years. And when he asked if I would come and invoke the name of one of our colleagues who'd also been here and had a great time, I was trying to think whether I had any connections to Ohio State, and it suddenly occurred to me that my grandparents, my father's parents, met here. My grandmother was a music major here in the 20s, and her sorority was hosting the All East football team out here to play in the East-West All-Star Game at the time that the stadium here was being inaugurated. This is the game that turned into the East-West Shrine Game. In any case, my grandfather, who was at Brown University, as I was on the team. And so they met here on campus and fell head over heels in love. And my grandfather, who was considering going off to be a professional baseball pitcher in the National League, was told by my little tiny grandmother to be that under no circumstances was she going to have anything to do with a professional athlete. And so he enrolled in the education program here at Ohio State and became an educator in life. So that is my connection to the university. And being reminded of that by my father, I thought it was going to be particularly enjoyable to come out here and spend some time in Columbus. I'm going to talk today about the complexities of the world of nature conservation, what it takes to safeguard the wildlife and the ecosystems on which all life on Earth depends. Based on my experience over the years with World Wildlife Fund and also in the nonprofit world more broadly. But before I give you some of the particulars of how people approach conservation these days, let me give you a sense of what is at stake. The sad truth is that the natural world is everywhere disappearing before our eyes. More than 6 billion people fill the planet, with a predicted 9 billion in the decades ahead. We're simply too many. The large numbers of poor struggling to raise the quality of their lives in any way they can, and the fewer affluent who nonetheless consume so much of nature's bounty. The litany, I think, is familiar to pretty much everybody. Half the great tropical forests have been cleared among the last global frontiers. Species of plants and animals are disappearing 100 times or more faster than before the coming of humanity. We have driven atmospheric carbon dioxide to the highest levels in at least 200,000 years and contributed to a global warming that will ultimately be bad news everywhere. Forests, freshwater, and marine systems alike are suffering. The world's forests reached their maximum extent 6,000 to 8,000 years ago at the dawn of agriculture and retreat of the continental glaciers. Today, with the spread of agriculture, only about half that forest cover remains, and it is being cut at an accelerating rate. Over 60% of temperate, hardwood, and mixed forest has been lost, 30% of coniferous forest, 45% of tropical rainforest, and 75% of tropical dry forest. And half of the surviving forest has been degraded, much of it severely. As forest habitat shrinks, so do the number of animal and plant species. Conservation biologists use the rule of thumb that if habitat is reduced to one-tenth its original size, animals and plants decline by about one-half. Removal of the final 10%, obviously, can wipe out that remaining half in a stroke. Our own national parks show this trajectory. With the smaller the park, the steeper the drop. In contrast, the largest reserves, such as the Joint Glacier National Park straddling Montana and Alberta, have not lost species. Yet getting large blocks of land set aside is difficult all around the world. The largest remaining intact areas of forest include the needleleaf forests of Canada and Russia and the rainforests of the Congo Basin, New Guinea, and largest of all, the Amazon. Vast as it is, though, even the expanse of Amazonian rainforest is not safe. With trees anchored by shallow root systems and easily bulldozed, then sawn into lumber, chipped or burned to make way for crops, Amazonian forests could disappear within decades. for tropical forests, despite their fabled exuberance, are more vulnerable and less resilient than most other ecosystems as a result of their nutrient-poor and erosion-prone soils. As damage to the forest spreads, new intrusions add and reinforce those impacts. During drought years in the El Niño cycle, the forests burn more fiercely. Equally disturbing is the reduction of atmospheric water over the Amazon. About half the rain falling in the Amazon comes from the forest itself, not from clouds blowing over rivers and oceans. Vapor generated by the Amazon forest is important globally, influencing weather patterns nearly half a world away. So to the extent that the Amazon is cut and burned, annual rainfall also declines, and wilderness remnants are stressed still more. Models of the process suggest that a tipping point exists that could cause the forest to collapse, turning much of its area into dry scrubland, with rainfall consequences far beyond the Amazon itself. Freshwater systems may be even more imperiled than the world's natural forests. Across the northern third of the planet, the most densely populated and industrialized, we convert almost all large rivers with dams and channels. Some are dammed along their entire length, and those running through dry lands are substantially modified. Not only do we take nearly all the water from some rivers, but we pollute our rivers with an array of byproducts from agriculture and industry, and that effluent in turn flows into the oceans. Freshwater rivers, lakes, and wetlands are hugely important biologically. While they contain only 0.01% of the planet's water, they hold a much larger fraction of the Earth's species. In fact, freshwater fishes alone comprise about 25% of all scientifically described vertebrate species. Scientists tell us that because their habitats are so vulnerable, freshwater species face an extinction risk about 5 times greater than that for terrestrial animals, and freshwater scarcity is looming as a problem around the world. Our oceans, too, are showing signs of abuse from poorly planned coastal development, overexploitation of marine resources, global warming, and burgeoning tourism. And unlike on land, the establishment of marine parks and protected areas is still in its infancy. Of the world's coral reefs, almost 60% are threatened by human activity, and 10% may be damaged beyond recovery. We've lost half the world's coastal wetlands in the last century. Seagrass beds, among the most productive sea life nurseries, are in retreat along virtually all inhabited coastal areas. Close to 70% of the world's beaches are eroding at higher than natural rates. Fishers go everywhere, from the pack ice of the Arctic to the pack ice of Antarctica, in winter and in summer. And with modern, sophisticated technology, virtually no potential fishery is too remote. Not only are 70% of fisheries overexploited or on the verge of becoming so, they also waste large amounts of unwanted fish and other animals, so-called bycatch, and physically damage reefs in the ocean floor. The ocean catch now yields about $2.5 billion to the U.S. economy and over $80 billion worldwide. But research reported in the Financial Times states that catch is down by half compared to 50 years ago, even though the effort to harvest these fish is up threefold and energy used in the process up tenfold. Aquaculture takes up part of the slack, but at rising environmental cost, converting wetlands valuable as nurseries, using fodder diverted from crop production, and often producing substantial pollution. Fish stocks, once thought to be inexhaustible, cod, haddock, herring, and many others, clearly are no longer. The sturgeon that produce caviar have been overfished. Wild Atlantic salmon have all but disappeared. California's Cannery Row hasn't produced sardines in a long time. Subsidies are among the largest driver of overfishing. In 1989, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization estimated the world catch at a total worth of $70 billion, while the annual cost of operating the global fishing fleet was estimated at $92 billion, including maintenance, fuel, insurance, supplies, gear, and labor costs. So, doing the math, that's a loss of $22 billion. The boats and equipment are worth about $320 billion, with a fraction, FAO suggested 10%, needed to pay off loans. So worldwide, the fishing industry was then losing about $54 billion a year. No private enterprise could long withstand such a bottom line, but most nations have found a variety of direct and indirect ways to support declining fishing industries. The Japanese Fisheries Association estimates the credit extended to its fisheries at about $19 billion. The European Union supports construction of new vessels and the modernization of old ones. Other nations guarantee fish price, subsidize fuel costs, or give outright grants for new boats and equipment. As these background comments suggest, a number of factors converge to produce alarming losses to the natural wealth of our planet. Sheer human numbers, increasing rates of consumption in developed and developing countries alike, and the globalization of the marketplace. So it's a daunting challenge to protect the natural world in which wildlife and human beings exist together. The conservation movement has really changed dramatically since I first became involved. But let me just take you back to a bit of the history of the movement. It really had its genesis in the early 20th century with hunter conservationists behind the establishment of national parks and so forth, like Teddy Roosevelt, a very prominent example. The movement became more formalized really right after the Second World War, at the same time that the United Nations was being created and the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund were being created. There was also an organization established called the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources. That is an institution that exists today. It was created to provide a framework for the collection of the best scientific information about species and habitats around the world. With the creation of IUCN, though, conservationists also found a need not only to provide funding for conservation projects, but also to carry out more hands-on and policy-related work on beyond the networking and data collection that IUCN was doing. And so through the late 50s and into the early 60s, some of the most prominent conservation organizations were created, among them the World Wildlife Fund, the organization with which I was associated for more than 20 years, which was created in 1961. And its evolution, not to be parochial about this, but the reason I talk about WWF is its evolution really in many respects mirrors that of the conservation world more broadly. We started out in 1961 with an emphasis on species conservation, on charismatic mammals, the elephants and tigers and rhinos, and of course the organization's charismatic symbol, the giant panda. So there was a lot of funding of hands-on field research. People largely from North America and from Europe going into the field to do very specific scientific research projects. That work rapidly expanded to encompass habitat. If you want to save species, obviously they need some place to be that is in reasonably good shape. And so the conservation movement began to emphasize also the creation of parks and protected areas that would provide adequate habitat for some of these flagship species. Well, by the 1970s, the groups largely based in North America and Europe were recognizing that sort of parachute conservation was not going to be successful for the long term. If these parks were going to be viable, you needed to have local capacity to manage and run them. And so the organizations began to invest substantially in capacity building, both individuals and the establishment of some NGOs, non-governmental organizations in developing countries, but also substantial support to strapped government agencies that had very, very few resources to carry out their mission in natural resource protection. Then in the 1980s, the movement expanded yet further to invest in the arena of conservation and development. The idea being that conservation and development, as some said, were two sides of the same coin. That what is good for human, social, and economic development can also be good for the protection of nature. So there was investment, a lot of it with funding from governments and large foundations, to experiment with projects on the ground that would generate income and opportunities for local people that was compatible with saving a park or a protected area. And then coincident with those projects, there was an increasing emphasis on working with the governments, particularly the aid agencies, on their agendas, trying to influence the policy process, get them to move conservation or conservation and development together up higher on their agendas. And so a greater emphasis both on policy and on advocacy. At the same time, there are huge questions about how you fund all of this. And so a new field emerged in conservation finance, the first iterations of which were the debt for nature swaps that you may have heard of. The debt for nature swaps, and when I was very much involved in these in the early days when I was at WWF, one of our board members, who was a prominent New York banker, who'd been working on the Mexican debt situation, among other things, said, gee, you know, if there are opportunities to deal with developing country debt owed to commercial banks productively to write down debt and put money into interesting infrastructure and other projects in countries like Mexico, maybe there's an opportunity in conservation as well. So the idea was that an organization like World Wildlife Fund would buy or have donated heavily discounted developing country debt and would then have it redeemed at either full face amount or some significant amount over the current trading price, and that difference would go into support for the conservation agenda of the country in question. In Ecuador, for example, to support the operations of the Galapagos National Park system. And from there, doing these one-off debt swaps, we moved into creation of conservation trust funds, getting development agencies, governmental agencies predominantly, to contribute funds as part of their development agenda for countries into new entities that would be separately incorporated, have not-for-profit and governmental representation on their boards of directors, be managed highly professionally, and like any other endowment, you know, or like many other endowments, a percentage of the proceeds from the capital would be allocated to running parks and protected areas in that country every year. And now there are institutions of this sort all around the world, some of them managing in excess of $100 million, which is a non-trivial sum, obviously, and particularly when you look at the kinds of budgets that park services often have. All right, so that gets us up to the 90s, when it had gotten, the scientists said, well, we're still not getting there. We really need to scale up our approaches. But first, let's take a comprehensive look at what's out there. What do we really know about what is most important biologically around the planet? And so the entire conservation community, working with academics, working with government agencies, began to develop conservation blueprints at what is called an eco-regional level. And so it's just a large landscape or seascape at a scale at which ecological processes actually work. So in most cases, much larger than a park, and including, of course, a lot of areas that are heavily settled, are going to be developed, and so forth. But it really did provide an exciting opportunity to get the entire conservation community together around a reasonably consistent set of priorities. And then with that, there was in parallel an effort to begin to try to harness market forces and to engage with the private sector. There really had been very little done by the conservation community with the private sector up until then. So, for example, one of the initiatives was the creation of something called the Forest Stewardship Council. This is an entity, again, it's a private organization that receives certification from certifiers who have met certain standards that forests are well managed. And with that, the wood that comes from those forests gets a Forest Stewardship Council seal of approval and can go into the marketplace, frequently not at a premium, but because a lot of purchasers, Home Depot, Walmart, are concerned about the sustainability and of their purchasing practices, they have moved to adopt the policy that they will seek their timber products from certified or close to certified sources. Same thing has happened in the marine environment when World Wildlife Fund and Unilever came together to create a similar certification scheme for marine fisheries. And so Alaska salmon is among the fisheries that has been certified. So if you go into a Whole Foods and you look on the at the fish and you'll see Alaska salmon, you'll see the little Marine Stewardship Council logo that tells you that these fish are being harvested sustainably. Along with this was more policy and advocacy work to change lending practices and to engage institutions like the World Trade Organization and other regional trading regimes. This is all reflecting the recognition that success in conservation requires addressing threats from the local to the global with an emphasis on finding really comprehensive long-term sustainable solutions. So let me turn to giving you a few real-world examples to illustrate just how far-reaching and interconnected our approaches to nature conservation have become, you know, starting one from Asia, one from Africa, and one from Latin America. First in Asia, the Tesonilo lowland forest of the island of Sumatra has been identified as the Earth's richest forest for vascular plants and is home to elephants, tigers, and orangutans. Industrial exploitation has already wiped out vast pockets of forest in Sumatra and converted them to fast-growing tree plantations and oil palm. Protecting the remainder has really been a race against time. Now, a tree from Tesonilo travels very widely. An Indonesian company, April, logs and pulps it. A Finnish company, UPM, turns it into paper in China. America's International Paper sells it to Hewlett-Packard, which in turn sells it to consumers across the United States for home and office printing. Along the way, the governments of Germany, the United States, Austria, and Japan provide export credits to their machine manufacturers to install pulping and papermaking machines in the various mills that handle the Tesso tree. So protecting Tesonilo requires not only stepped-up anti-poaching patrols and efforts to give the area park status, but also identifying the chain of investors, creditors, financial advisors, processors, merchants, and customers who handle the tree. It means engaging them one by one, telling the story of Tesonilo, and asking them to use their influence with Indonesian business partners and companies to help protect the remaining forest and to operate in the most environmentally sensitive way possible. Now, the story is far from over, but we've had some really encouraging success. First, there is now a national park there that was created just this year. That took a long time and a lot of advocacy, some of it local, some of it regional, some of it international. The pulp and paper company has changed its practices. It has supported the establishment of the new national park. It has pledged that it will enforce logging restrictions and make sure that its people are not engaged in what has been really rampant illegal logging, and that it will work to eliminate some of the most problematic logging concessions. At the same time, there has been really good work with the local communities, helping them to find income-generating alternatives. As I said before, nothing works for the long term unless there is real participation and perceived benefit by the people who are living in and around these resources. And so finding ways for them to benefit has really been critical. And then what may seem trivial but has been very important to the communities, we've had something called flying elephant patrols. Well, flying elephant patrols, to go from export credit agencies to flying elephant patrols, the flying elephant patrols are domestic elephants that go out and basically scare away the wild elephants. The wild elephants are terrible, terrible pests. They are very smart. They are very large, and they know their way into people's agricultural lands. They, in a night, a herd of wild elephants can destroy everything that's out there. So the flying elephant patrols, you've got to mahoot and go out there, and the domestic elephants make sure that at least some number of the wild elephants are deterred from coming into the area, along with electric fences and various things of that sort. But elephants are really smart, and they figure those things out pretty quickly. In any case, that's Tesonilo in Sumatra. Moving to Africa and the Congo Basin, recent trends there show that trade in illegal bushmeat has accelerated rapidly, posing an immediate threat to chimpanzees and a lot of other forest creatures. The rising quantities of this bushmeat aren't going to support local communities who are eating this wildlife, but instead they're going into towns and cities pretty far away from the forest where people have developed a taste for this bushmeat, which is considered now quite desirable. The conservation response in the Congo Basin also starts with the basics. Traditional tools, wildlife surveys, anti-poaching units, improving park management, expanding the number of parks. But taking a closer look at the issues, we found that new roads, primarily for logging, had opened up access to poachers. So getting a handle on logging led us to discussions with governments on improving forest concessions and the rules that govern the granting of concessions, introducing options for sustainable forest management, introducing the notion of the Forest Stewardship Council and so forth, and promoting independent monitoring and certification. But it gets more complicated because looking at the poachers themselves, we discovered that many of them were new arrivals in the forest. They were displaced fishermen from coastal villages whose lagoons had been depleted and were no longer providing adequate fishing for their families. So what was happening? Well, it was highly subsidized Spanish trawlers that had come in along shore and were basically siphoning up all the fish as they were heading into the lagoon that had caused the fish populations in the lagoon and along the coast to crash. So today's world, policy and advocacy efforts with trade organizations in Brussels and Geneva to reduce trade-distorting and environmentally damaging fish subsidies is a conservation tool that links directly back to the fate of chimpanzees in the Congo. So, back to the Amazon. This is perhaps the biggest conservation initiative ever in the Brazilian Amazon, responding to concerns over dramatic forest loss. And you may have seen some of the satellite imagery over time of the way that Amazonian rainforest is shrinking. In 2002, at the Johannesburg Summit on Sustainability, UN Summit, there was an agreement signed among World Wildlife Fund, the World Bank, the government of Brazil, and the Global Environment Facility, which is a grant-making arm of the World Bank and the UN Development Program and the UN Environment Program. This was about the biggest commitment ever made in conservation terms because the government of Brazil pledged to set aside 10% of the Brazilian Amazon in protected areas. That is an area of almost 200,000 square miles, or the size of the state of California. This wouldn't have happened without, first of all, really painstaking work in advance on analysis of the biology and the species distribution throughout the Brazilian Amazon, looking at land tenure issues, working with federal, state, local, tribal groups throughout. That was a process, both scientifically and in political terms, that took several years before this agreement was signed in 2002. Same time, of course, it took real political leadership, and that meant getting to personally to then President Cardoso of Brazil and then President of the World Bank, Jim Wolfensohn, and to get them personally to push this through their Cardoso through the government and Wolfensohn through the World Bank institution. This is something for which the price tag is about $400 million over 10 years. There have been some really exciting milestones. A new park was created not long after the agreement was signed called Tumucumaque. It's up in the northeastern Brazilian Amazon adjacent to Suriname and the Guyanas. It's a new park of 9.5 million acres, the world's biggest tropical forest park. The parks are only part of the strategy. It also calls for the establishment of extractive reserves. That's a term that's used in Brazil, and these are public lands that are protected for use by local people for such sustainable activities such as a collection of Brazil nuts and so forth, non-use of non-timber resources. Also, the establishment of sustainable logging concessions. And in addition, the support to an organization that already existed to manage a trust fund that would support the operating costs of these new parks throughout the Brazilian Amazon. Another point about this kind of work is that governments change and World Bank leadership changes. And so just as you're getting momentum and you're getting systems in place, there's a new team. And they bring in lots of new people all the way down to the ground. And so conservation is really an iterative process, an iterative undertaking. Fortunately, both President Lula and now President Wolfowitz of the World Bank have maintained their commitment to this project, more than just a project, but really a flagship initiative for the Amazon. As well as political changes, you know, you're always dealing, too, with economic pressures. And so Brazil, which is the world's second largest exporter of soybeans, has been busily converting a lot of land, largely in southern Brazil, but reaching up into the Amazon for soy production. And the higher the price of soybeans in the global market, the more pressure there is to transform land. Now, most recently, whether it is because of new protected areas, whether it is because the price of soy has gone down a little bit, the most recent work done by the Brazilian government, looking at all the satellite data and so forth, shows that the deforestation rates in the Amazon are down by about 10%, down from what had been clearing of 10,000 square miles of Amazonian tropical forest every year. So stopping nature's loss requires a multiplicity of tools and approaches, from working on the ground with park rangers and local communities, fostering the best scientific understanding and analysis possible, giving consumers the information they need to make the best choices, advancing arguments within multilateral institutions, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and getting into corporate boardrooms to test ideas and promote solutions. To be successful these days, a conservationist needs to be part biologist, part economist, part diplomat, part social scientist, and part international finance expert. As I suggested, you know, this is not a field in which one declares success and moves along. It is iterative and tough work. It has all of the messiness associated with it of large social and economic processes. But despite the fact that most of the indicators are still pretty grim around the world, I take comfort, and I think most of us in the conservation community do, from the fact that we've seen some really substantial successes and at a scale that is really meaningful. So this is a job that we are, you know, forging away at and really committed to, obviously, at the end of the day, because without a healthy planet, we as humans are not going to be healthy ourselves. And it's a job that I would urge everybody, no matter what your discipline or your professional trajectory, to take up. Each of us has the ability and the opportunity to make a difference. whether it is in our communities, in our places of employment. We learn about the issues if we speak up on the issues and if we take action to support those who are working in a more applied way. As my colleague, John Sawhill, who used to run the Nature Conservancy, said, in the end, our society will be defined not only by what we create, but also by what we refuse to destroy. Thank you. Yeah, well, there's a very good book called The Beak of the Finch. Would be one. It's very well written. It's really accessible. And you could read just about anything by E.O. Wilson. He's a magnificent writer. And some of his pieces on biodiversity. Also, there is a lot. Now, it's kind of a daunting book in some ways, but there is a lot in Jared Diamond's most recent book, Collapse, that pulls all of these threads together as he tells the story of different civilizations and tries to sort through why some collapsed and why some didn't, and in his view, a lot of it has to do with how humans were managing their environments. So those would be three arenas for starters. In the back, yeah. Well, not surprisingly, WWF used to be involved in production of curricular materials, and we put together some wonderful middle school materials on biodiversity that are being used still, doing a lot of training of the teacher training. But we moved away from that in part because we couldn't retail. You know, WWF in the United States has a budget of, I don't know, maybe $140 million a year. It's a big organization, but, you know, if you look at all the different things you're doing, we decided that we weren't, that we shouldn't be investing in curricular materials. So now a lot of it really is web-based. And working with other institutions to link up scientific information and advocacy alerts. And so you can go on any number of different websites and drill back and forth. I think that the question really is how to reach young people, and we're not going to reach them with traditional teaching methodologies. Because the messages in conservation can be pretty grim, I think it's also, and that can be very off-putting, that one of the emphases is on providing, not to be Pollyanna-ish about it, but real-world examples of success stories to get people motivated to learn more, to feel that it isn't just a lost cause. There are other organizations that focus more specifically on, K-12 education. And there's a lot that's done at the university and level on providing support to grad students and postdocs who are working in interesting areas of conservation biology by a lot of different organizations. If that answers the question. Yeah.
interesting. Near the end of your speech, you mentioned that to get to this business, you need to be part economist, part diplomat, part scientist, I guess there are a few others. But lawyer wasn't among them. Oversight?
No, I guess that because I'm a lawyer, I assume that is a given. No, obviously, if you're working, when I went to law school, I took all the usual things, and then, as you heard, I found myself at the Office of Legal Counsel. It never occurred to me that I was going to be negotiating debt for nature swaps, and I suddenly found that the corporate law that I had done and some of, some bits and pieces here and there, or, the course I took on securities law, these various things really broadened my base and my ability to speak persuasively with a lot of different audiences. And certainly in the policy arena, and it's very much true at WWF, I would say that in the NGO community, maybe 50% of the policy experts are lawyers. And the other thing you learn as a lawyer, I think, is you really craft your ability to hone your ability to communicate both verbally and in writing, and to think about audiences, who it is you're trying to speak to. So I didn't mean to omit the legal profession. Yeah.
Okay.
I really do think that having a broad background, understanding a lot of different perspectives, is very important. As I said, when I went to law school, it was the idea I had been working at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. I was an English major, right? But I wanted to be a field person, like Jane Goodall or something. Anyway, I got this job at Harvard, and I was able to go study wildebeest behavior in Tanzania's Ngorongoro crater. So why did I go to law school? Because I had an English degree, I couldn't type, I had no skills, and I thought, well, what are my options? I could go to business school, I could go to law school, I could go back to undergraduate school and study science, I could become a librarian, I could do anything. And I thought, well, if I go to law school, I can develop a variety of different skills. And I didn't concentrate on environmental law at all. I took as broad an array of courses as possible, and I didn't get into the environment right away. I clerked for a year, and then I found myself at the Office of Legal Counsel, and which, as I said in the beginning, was just an extraordinary and life-shaping experience in terms of contributing to the policy process and feeling as if you're making a difference. So I advise people who are interested in working in a multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary world to take that into account when they're picking their courses and picking the kinds of jobs that they do in between school years and so forth.
About
And this is, I would say, that you still find, well, this is work in progress. And many organizations find this too hard. You know, they really want to back away. They're afraid they'll be tainted. They're afraid they'll get into over their heads. You know, WWF has tried to tackle some of this. It is complicated because, as you know, not all privatizations work very well in developing countries or others, and so you can get tagged with that. On the other hand, in some cases, water privatizations and others, it really has provided a benefit to local communities and an opportunity to infuse an environment and sustainability agenda. So it is, it's very much work in progress. And trying to be, it just goes back to the question of the kinds of disciplines. So you want people who understand that world on your staff and on your board, and along with the biologists and the and others who are working on these things. But yes, there's definitely a tension that has both upside and downside. Yes, the green shirt.
I work for the Nature Conservancy, and I just wanted to offer opportunities for my lawyer friends to come and volunteer for a small dollars right here in Columbus.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, as you know, as somebody who's in this field, this has been a very hot topic for quite last several years, and something that many donors are promoting. It is I find it difficult because many of the measures, the easy measures, don't tell you that much. You know, you can look at number of acres or hectares in protected areas. You can look at a lot of the things that are simple, and they don't really tell you as much as you would want to know. And finding the linkages, you know, so if the standard of living improves at the local level, and there's been a big investment of conservation resources, you know, it's tempting for the conservation organizations to take credit, but there's so many different factors at play. So I think that the pressure from donors to, and it's not just in conservation, it's in every other arena these days, you know, people who are comfortable with objective measures in pushing for all their grantees to describe themselves in those terms does a lot of the work a disservice. Now, I'm a big governance person, and not-for-profits have to be much more professional and responsible and so forth, but I don't know that metrics is that satisfying, personally. Yes. Right behind you, and then. Okay.
I think a big issue facing our country is AMLR. I was wondering, you know, does WWF or any other organizations involved in deal with that issue?
Oh, the whole conservation environmental community came together very powerfully, and this is something that's also not going to be over. The fact that we won the last time around doesn't mean that it isn't going to come around and again, particularly given all of the concerns about energy security. But WWF, the Bering Sea area is one of the most biologically significant marine areas in the world. So from a biological perspective, we're there, along with the Nature Conservancy, in fact, with whom we have a partnership there. And so different organizations, you know, bring different kinds of expertise. Some are real advocacy, lobbying, some litigating organizations, and others that are much more science and field-based. But this was, I think, a real people say that NGOs should be working together better. We don't work together well enough. There are too many organizations. Why don't you all merge? You know, but I think this is an example where people really came together in a powerful way and in a tough fight and at least won that battle. Population numbers certainly have a lot to do with the equation, but levels of consumption are just as important. So if you look at the footprint that we have globally, you know, here in the United States, in terms of energy, natural resource consumption, you know, we contribute something on the order of 20% or more of the CO2 emissions globally. Okay. So at the end of the day, the question is, if everybody in the world aspires to the standard of living we have, and you've got 50% more people, then it's really a losing battle. It is also at the same time true that in places where family size is very large, puts a huge amount of pressure. Poor people who are having big families because they need kids to work in the field and get the water, and a lot of them aren't living very long, so they're having children as part of an old age policy as well. It puts huge stress on these systems. There, I think one of the most important levers is in fact education. And particularly educating girls, because the data show that the more women receive education, the better, more informed choices, better opportunities they have, the more informed choices they can make about family size. And so you do tend to see family size coming down. So it's a very complicated equation, and needless to say, it's not exactly popular for folks from the United States to go into the rest of the world and say, you're having too many children, while we are living this life that is producing at least as much stress on the planet. In the back.
Thank you.
Well, it's hard to be terribly encouraged here in the United States, where every effort to increase the fuel efficiency standards doesn't even get a serious hearing. No, precisely. And there is not, in this country, enough of a tradition or a culture or commitment to conservation. The only thing we saw was something of a decline in the purchases of SUVs when fuel prices went up. The U.S. government has just announced a climate change initiative, which has some good aspects to it. It's, you know, investing in hydrogen and so forth. But there's nothing in it that really provides incentives for individuals and families and institutions to change the way they use resources. Nor indeed is there, and this is of course true in many arenas, nor is there enough money for some of the R&D. Other parts of the world, I was in Iceland last week, and interestingly there 70% of the energy use is renewable. It's hydropower and geothermal. Now, that's what Iceland has, is stranded energy. You know, it's the 30%, they're trying to move to hydro. So they have some hydrogen buses and so forth. But one of the big problems they have is that their fishing fleet is running on oil, right? And their fishing fleet is subsidized, and their fishing is the sort of number two item in the country. So even in a place that has as a goal to become 100% renewable over the next 20 years, you see just real tensions. When I think it's tough when people would ask me, you know, well, what can I do to save a tiger, to save the tigers in the wild? And your response is, as an individual, you can support energy efficiency in your own life and in your communities. And people don't find that a very satisfying response, but it is, in fact, one of the most important ones. And we will see, obviously, with the growth of China in particular and India and other countries, you know, increasing, you know, carbon-intensive economies that are going to be very, very difficult in terms of environment and nature conservation. So, you know, Mr. Gore has a compelling message, and I hope it gets heard and appreciated as broadly as possible. Yes, right in front, yes. That's why in this Amazon initiative, you know, there's a lot of the funding is to go for the management of parks that are existing or going to be established for just that, for number one, because if you don't have the funding for salaries and or, you know, the salary of the one, let alone the number of people you need, it won't ever be anything other than a paper park. But the capacity building is really important. That is, I think, partly a question of supporting the field. You know, conservation, the field of conservation in many places has not been considered a very serious one. You know, people go into other arenas, and the places where one does conservation work are sometimes pretty far away from, particularly if you're in the Brazilian Amazon. But so providing opportunities for people who want to make a commitment to conservation to expand their skills in a lot of different ways. Again, it's not simply being good at understanding the delineation of the park and the biology of the species living in it, but it is also you've got to be really good at community relations, and you have to understand the pushes and pulls of the economic process that is having an impact on the protected area. At WWF, there was when one of the giants of the conservation world is a man named Russell Train. He was an administrator of the EPA. He was undersecretary of Interior and a variety of other things. He was also one of the founders of WWF and was the chairman of the board, was the CEO, chairman of the board for a number of years. When he stepped down as chairman, we started something called Education for Nature Fund, specifically to provide training opportunities, short courses or degree courses for people who are working in and around biologically important areas. And so it's not enough, but it's something. Supporting local educational institutions, making sure that there are good programs in the local universities that are also starved is really important. You know, it's one of the things I take a lot of pride in at the Ford Foundation is the fact that its biggest grant ever has been in not just in conservation but in the field of capacity building. Just recognizing that people have got to have skills and backing if they're going to be undertaking the tough social and political and economic challenges. That's right.
Kathy, yeah.
Okay. Whatever you want to do. There. Yes. Okay. And then behind you. Oh, I mean, the opportunities to do some of the things I've done. You know, ride around on the back of an elephant looking for rhinos in Chitwan National Park in Nepal and have, you know, while you're tracking a rhino, suddenly a tiger jumps out of the brush and then the elephant rears back up and trumpets, and it's quite thrilling. Or the walking along next to a river in Bhutan, and the python crosses, you know, from one side to the other. Or, you know, I mean, these things are so amazing. Going to see the mountain gorillas, you know, it's very. Or going, I mean, it doesn't have to be big mammals. It's, you know, going to maybe one of the most moving experiences was the overwintering habitat of the monarch butterflies in these little communities up outside, maybe 3-4 hours outside Mexico City. And so all of the monarchs from east of the Rocky Mountains overwinter in these OML fir forests mostly in the state of Michoacán. And to go up there, you see the challenges and the beauty and the imperative so dramatically, because when you get into where the butterflies are, these trees are just covered with butterflies. You can't even see the trees. And as the sun comes, warms them up, they start to flutter. And then they kind of cascade off the trees, and the only thing you can hear, it's like the wind, but it's the sound of butterfly wings. It's really magnificent. Around those areas is grinding poverty, grinding rural poverty of families with many children trying to grow corn on steeply eroded slopes, and a huge amount of illegal logging going on despite the protected area status, despite the commitment of the Mexican government, despite the fact that the world spotlight has been shown on the situation of the monarch. So experiences like that are very beautiful, very moving, they're very complicated ones, very profound. So, behind you, yeah. First, let me explain the WWF network. WWF has offices in about 100 countries around the world. It started out in developing countries, the U.S., U.K., basically places where you could raise money and then put it into the field. But over our 40 years of, plus of existence, there are offices that are separately incorporated in many instances in developing countries as well. But in terms of the funding of the program, most the revenues raised by WWF in the United States are about almost a third of what is raised globally. And most of the other two-thirds is raised in Europe. So there isn't a huge philanthropic base in many of the places where we work, although increasingly both foundations and government agencies are putting money directly into locally incorporated organizations. And so now, where money might have come to WWF in the U.S. and then gone to Brazil, it now goes directly to WWF Brazil or to WWF Philippines, or corporate funding for that matter. WWF has a really, in the United States in particular, a really diverse variety of funding sources. So we've got a membership of 1.2 million people, and that's really important because it gives you some political clout when you enter into the advocacy arena and policy arena, but also because it's a hugely important source of unrestricted funding that allows you to try to stay on mission so that you're not being driven by the interests of donors. And then we get money from foundations and corporations and governments and earned income from endowment and marketing income and so forth. It's not unlike the Nature Conservancy in that respect. And we're pretty tiny compared to the Nature Conservancy, at least in the United States, right? So it's variable. It is interesting to give you an example of how complex things can be. WWF has a new partnership with that was finalized since I left with Coca-Cola on to quite a generous one to support freshwater conservation in some key places around the world. Well, needless to say, our colleagues at WWF India are tearing their hair out because of the image of Coca-Cola in India. So here you have this global network with separately incorporated institutions, and so there's nobody who's the boss of somebody else, and you get into a lot of social cultural differences about what kind of funding is desirable in some circumstances, and you know you have to work that through. One of the things that I think not just in the conservation world, but in the philanthropic world more broadly, that we're all focusing on is trying to support the evolution of private philanthropy in countries that are developing, where there is a where there is a fair amount of wealth. You know, there's no reason really that in Brazil you can't support a vibrant conservation community, but it isn't quite there yet, or in Mexico or in Indonesia and a number of other places. So that's part of the challenge as well, is really trying to change the way that not just the societies are thinking about philanthropy, but to get back to the point about laws, you know, are there going to be charitable giving incentives built into legislation and so forth? So.
I thought you'd like that.